Yeah, I actually have a question about the DCF.
Go ahead.
How strictly should we be sticking to the format that you use in the valuation spreadsheets that you had sent us out previously for Heineken, for Tesla and those other companies?
When you say format, are you saying how closely are you going to have to use that same spread? I mean, ultimately, what am I looking for? Free cash flow to the firm, right? So whatever spreadsheet you need to get there, I'm okay with it. Just remember, if you're building your own spreadsheet, you have to still stay true to the consistency issues. So if you have your own ways of checking for consistency, that's okay. Just make sure your spreadsheet, whatever it is not an investment banking spreadsheet. Investment banking spreadsheets are awful. They have no internal consistency test. So this is not about building line items. It's about building a company that you're valuing. And if you can do it with your own spreadsheet, I have absolutely no qualms about, or any problems with you using a different format.
Gotcha. Okay, so following templates that you've sent us previously, so that would be a good place to start with this, though.
Yeah, I think why make yourself an Excel ninja and start from scratch? I mean, ultimately, the end game is the same, no matter what you're. So if you decide that you don't want to estimate reinvestment using sales to capital, you can take my existing spreadsheet and tweak it and make it revolve around whatever you think is right to estimate reinvestment. So I think it makes sense to actually start with an existing spreadsheet and build on it rather than start from scratch, because that's going to take you a long time. And when my experience, when you build spreadsheets, you're always going to screw up the first four, five, six iterations because there's going to be something you forget. So it's probably better to start with an existing spreadsheet and tweak it rather than build from scratch.
Okay, and one final question. If we had selected a company that you ended up sending us a valuation
It
for,
doesn't matter.
okay.
I mean, let's face it, we talked about stories. Your story for a company and mine will almost never converge. And even if they do converge, our numbers will not be the same. So it's perfectly okay. There are probably at least a dozen companies where there are four or five people in this class valuing that same company. Companies like Netflix and Microsoft and Apple. I'll wager that no two of you end up with the same value or even close to the same value. I mean, you might get close to the same value, but no, each person has a different experience.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Okay, folks, I think it's where, let's see how many people are in. So 115. So people are coming in. So let me get started. Welcome, and I hope you're all well. But let me very quickly review what we did on Monday. And Monday, we were talking about how critical it is when you do valuation that you start with a story. I said every valuation starts with a story. And that story is ultimately what shows up as an Excel spreadsheet. And we went through the first three steps. I said to value your company, you first need to understand the landscape, get a sense of what your company does, what does well, what it does badly, the competition, the market. And then once you've got that, I said, you can tell a story about your company. And then once you've told the story, I said, make sure the story you've told is not a fairy tale, that it's not impossible, that it's not implausible, and it's not improbable. Sounds again like I'm playing on words, but go back and review that section because you want to make sure that you're being honest with yourself. And once you've passed it through the test, we're ready to go. Because today's session, here's what I'd like to do. I'd like to put the finishing touches. So if you remember for Uber, the story I told was that of a company that was essentially an urban car service company that would attract new users into the business, had local networking benefits, and could keep doing what they were doing, which is not own the cars, not hire the drivers, and keep 20% of the fare. That was in June of 2015, 2014. So here's what you're going to see on this page. I know there's a lot of stuff on this page, so let me take you step by step. I'm going to try to connect my story to explicit numbers. First, I described Uber as an urban car service company. You know where this shows up in the valuation? The total market that I went after was the urban car service market in June of 2014. And in June of 2014, the urban car service market globally was about $100 billion. And I'll be quite honest, getting a number on this market was really, really difficult to do. Because in June of 2014, if you think about how the urban car service market was structured around the world, it was taxi cabs in individual cities. There were no publicly traded companies. And here's what I had to do. I had to go city by city collecting data on the size of the taxi cab market until I got to an estimate for the global market. So take it or leave it, my estimate of the total urban car service market was about $100 billion. That market had been growing at about 2% a year. I allowed it to grow 6% a year. Why? Because in my story, I assume that Uber and other ride-sharing companies are going to be able to attract users into this market that otherwise would not have taken taxi cabs. So the extra 4% are for people like my son and my niece, who normally would not have been people who take cabs, but who now would take a ride-sharing service. So $100 billion growing at 6% capture the fact it's an urban car service company attracting new users. I gave Uber a 10% market share of this market. Now, by itself, it might not sound like much, but if you remember how this market was structured, it was a hugely fragmented market, and 10% would have been an immense market share. But I stopped at 10%, and here's why. In my story, I assumed Uber would have local networking benefits. So in my story, Uber could take New York, Lyft can take Chicago, Didi can take Beijing. So in my story, you can have a dozen different ride-sharing companies in different parts of the world dominating different sections. So I had to stop at 10%. I couldn't give Uber a 40% market share. So again, my story is driving my market share. I gave Uber a 40% operating margin. That sounds sky high, right? But if you remember, in 2014, Uber's business was a brokering business. They were intermediaries. They had basically no infrastructure costs. Their margins in steady state, assuming they can get to steady state, are going to be sky high. The 40% margin assumes that they can keep the 20% of the fare that they're keeping right now, which is a very big slice for a broker to keep. And that translates into high margins. Again, my story is driving the margin. And finally, to estimate reinvestment, I fell back on my story. In my story, remember, Uber doesn't own the cars. They don't hire the drivers. So for them, scaling up is going to be very easy to do. And the way I reflected this is with that sales to invested capital ratio. Again, you see that number that you saw me, you know, that you've seen me use before in my valuations. And for Uber, I set that number at 5. To give you some perspective, that number is about 2 for a typical US company. It's about 3 for a very good technology company. It's about 4 for an online advertising company like Facebook or Google, which has very little capital investment. I gave Uber $5 of revenues for every dollar of capital. Again, why? Because they don't own the cars and they don't hire the drivers. So I've got my revenue growth, I've got my margins, I've got my market share, and I've got my reinvestment. Then he said, what kind of cost of capital did you give them? I'll tell you what I did not do. I did not estimate a beta and a cost of equity and a cost of debt and a debt ratio, because to me, that's not the big issue in this valuation. And remember, in 2014, none of the traditional measures you could use, there's no regression beta you could look up for Uber. So you know what I did? I went to the 90th percentile of cost of capital for all global companies. And that's one reason why I do these histograms at the start of every year. It makes my life easier during the course of the year. So I have the cost of capital for every publicly traded company in the world. So 43,000 companies, I have a histogram. And I have a histogram for just US companies. And in 2014, the 90th percentile of that histogram was 12%. I gave them a 12% cost of capital and I moved on. Now, is it possible that I could finesse this cost of capital and end up with 11.73%? Yes, but who cares? In this valuation, you want to spend your time where it matters, which is on revenue growth and margins. So if any of you are valuing really young companies, don't get bogged down in the cost of debt or the cost of equity or the cost of capital. In fact, I've got quite a few emails from people valuing young companies and then trying to compute a synthetic rating for their company. And the company is losing money. So what do I do? And my first question is, how much debt do you have? And if you have very little debt, why are you wasting your time even finessing this number? Just use a BBB rating and move on. Because after all, in a DCF valuation, you're assuming a going concern. And this particular assumption is not even going to move your cost of capital a decimal point. So I'm focusing attention on things that matter. And the cost of capital is something I'm just going to pull off the histogram. Now, incidentally, when I value Uber at the discounted cash flow model, I'm implicitly assuming that Uber will make it as a going concern. And Uber in June of 2014 was still a young money-losing company. And there's a chance it will not make it. And my discounted cash flow valuation cannot reflect it. So here's what I did. I said a 10% chance that Uber would not make it. So let's see what this gives us. Okay? If I take all of those assumptions and convert them to numbers, here's what the numbers look like. My revenues are based upon the total market growing at 6% a year and giving Uber a 10% market share. So if you look at the market, my market share climbs over time, the revenues reflect that. The amount of those revenues they get to keep, though, is only 20%. I'm assuming that stays the same. So my revenues in year 10 are $3.6 billion. Now, this looks like a spreadsheet, right? I mean, it's got all of the line items you see in a spreadsheet, but every number on the spreadsheet has a story behind it. So if you ask me, why are my revenues $3.6 billion in year 10? The answer I'm not going to give you is because I used a 30% growth rate for the first 5 years and 5% thereafter. I'm going to tell you the story that I told for Uber. It's an urban car service company with a 10% with local networking benefits. If you ask me why my margins are so high, I'm going to say it's because they keep 20% of the fare. Why is my reinvestment so low? Because they don't own the cars. They don't hire the drivers. Why is my cost of capital 12% to start? Because they're a young, risky company. Why is it changing over time? Because what am I doing on my spreadsheet? I'm taking it from being a young, risky company to a mature company. And if you're wondering where the 8% cost of capital is coming from, and I see a couple of questions in the chat already from that, that was the median cost of capital for a US company in 2014. So I'm actually using that same histogram, starting at the 90th percentile when I start my valuation in Uber as a young, risky company, and moving it towards the 8% as the company gets larger and more profitable. This spreadsheet reflects my story, and based on my spreadsheet and my story and the numbers that come out of it, the value that I get for Uber before adjusting for failure risk is about $6.6 billion. So valued as a going concern, they're worth about $6.6 billion. But remember, there's a 10% chance they will not make it. So I ask myself, what will my equity be worth if Uber doesn't make it? And let's face it, Uber has nothing to liquidate. If they don't make it, my equity is going to be worth nothing. So I take an expected value. If any of you are valuing really young companies, this is especially the case if you're valuing startups. Remember, 2/3 of startups don't make it. If you do a discounted cash flow valuation to value a startup, you're going to overvalue the startup before you adjust for failure risk. Here, the failure risk is 10%. And adjusted for the failure risk, the value that I get for Uber is $6 billion. This was on June 8th of 2014. Remember, the first time I'd heard of Uber was 5 days prior when I read that Wall Street Journal article that said that VCs had invested $3 billion in Uber and they priced the company. Does anybody remember what they priced the company at? The news stories did mention it. It was $17 billion. So the story that initiated my interest in Uber was that story. Yeah. So I finished this this post and I put it on my blog June 8th of 2014. I think it was a Friday at about 3:15 in the afternoon. 10 minutes later, I get a call from a Wall Street Journal reporter. I don't know what she was doing. She must have been just waiting at her desk for this blog post to come out. She said, "I just noticed you valued Uber on your blog." I said, "Thank you for noticing." She said, "I noticed you also valued the company at $6 billion." I said, "You're very observant." Then she said, "You know, venture capitalists have valued the company at $17 billion." I almost corrected her then and there. You know, with what? That they're pricing the company, not valuing it. But I let it go. She's a journalist. I said, "Yes, I know they're valuing it at $17 billion." She said, "How do you explain the $17 billion?" I said, "I don't have to. I didn't pay it. I have never felt the urge to explain what other people pay." So when you look at, so she said, "Are you telling me they're wrong?" I said, "Look, I'm telling you nothing of the sort." I said, "With my story and my value, I wouldn't buy Uber. But with their story, maybe it's much bigger, and their value, maybe they have a good reason to buy it at $17 billion." And that's the way I think about valuation. I don't have the valuation of Zoom or the valuation of Boeing or the valuation of Uber. I have my valuation of Zoom, my valuation of Boeing, my valuation of Uber. My decisions are driven by my valuation. Your valuation of Uber should drive your decisions. So essentially, that's what valuation is. It's personal. You tell a story about a company, and that story gives you a valuation. Now, one of the questions that's been asked is, do I incorporate any of the regulatory government risk that Uber is facing? Because let's face it, around the world, there's pushback against Uber, especially in Europe. Of course, it's got to be reflected in your market share. So if in your story, you're more pessimistic than I am about what the future will bring, that you feel that the regulatory pushback is going to be much stronger for Uber than I am, then you're going to give them a lower market share, perhaps higher costs and lower margins. So bring in whatever you're concerned about into your story. Don't worry about it afterwards because it's too late. So any questions on the Uber story converted into Uber numbers? Okay. So basically, the story becomes numbers. The cost of capital allows me to adjust, predict the present value, and come up with the value of the company today. So I finished this valuation, and I posted on my blog on June 8th of 2014. And I get incredibly lucky because it gets picked up in four very different places. The first place it got picked up was 538.com. I don't know whether you're familiar with this site. It's a site maintained by a guy called Nate Silver. He's a statistics math geek. It's a great site if you like numbers. So basically, it's still open. I think they're owned by, I don't even know who owns them, but they're now part of a larger enterprise. Maybe ESPN owns them. I know somebody owns them. But they're a site where you can go and they look at the numbers and they try to make, you know, they try to use the numbers to answer questions. So ESPN owns them. So the person who runs the site called me and they said, look, the people who read our site are people who like numbers. They would love to have this blog post on there. Can we post your blog post with the valuation? I said, be my guest. So they posted the entire post with my valuation of Uber. The second place I got a call from was the Forbes blog. You know who reads the Forbes blog? I think 70-year-olds with flip phones. It's a really old value investing crowd. And the Forbes blog editor said, look, can we post your blog with the valuation? Our readers are very interested in how these young companies get valued. The third place that I got a call from was a site called TechCrunch. TechCrunch is a Silicon Valley publication. It's read mostly by geeks, VC geeks, tech geeks. They said, can we post your blog? Our readers are very interested in Uber. I said, be my guest. And then the final place I got a call from was a site called The Ride Sharing Guy. It's actually still around. It's a very interesting site. It's a site for Uber and Lyft drivers. You say, how many can there be? Do you know how many people drove for Uber last year? Almost 4 million people drove for Uber around the world. This is a big market. He said, can I carry your Uber valuation? Because I have a lot of Uber drivers, obviously, on my side, and they'd love to see this. And I said, be my guest. Same post, same valuation, four different sites. So I wait, and I start getting feedback on all four, very different kinds of feedback. On the 538.com side, this is the kind of question I get. So reader reads the evaluation and he says, I noticed you used a 12% cost of cap for Uber and you claimed it was the 90th percentile. I looked at your histogram and your 90th percentile was 11.97%. Why didn't you use 11.97%? This is how numbers geeks think. And the reason I always leave my spreadsheets open is I said, why don't you try 11.97% instead of 12% and see what happens to the value. 5 minutes later, I get an email back saying, nothing happened. I can see why you did what you did. So the 538.com, the kind of questions and feedback I got was pretty useless. The Forbes.blog, people loved it. They said, this is amazing. This is how tech companies should be valued. I completely ignored the site. What am I going to gain by people patting me on the back saying, this is how you should do things? The TechCrunch people absolutely hated what I did. Their response was, how dare you? How dare you value one of ours with your D.C.F? We don't do that in Silicon Valley. There were about 4,000 comments on the TechCrunch article. Half were pure insults. Some of them I didn't even know what to make of. One said, you DCF guy. That's it. That's the whole comment. What does that even mean, DCF guy? Is that good? Is that bad? I have no idea. One said, you New Yorker, you finance. I mean, basically, it was things coming out of left field. I ignored the pure abuse. The other half started with an abusive comment. You idiot. You know nothing about ride sharing. And then proceeded to tell me things about the technology of ride sharing that I did not know about. I'm not a tech person. I don't know how this ride sharing networking benefit works. And they told me. And if I just stopped at the insult, I'd never have read that because I learned about the ride sharing business by reading those comments. And finally, on the ride sharing guy, and Lyft drivers, and heard things I would never have heard. I just talked to Uber top management. Here's what I heard from an Uber driver in LA. He said, I drive for Uber in LA, and I know Uber goes around telling people they keep 20% of the fare, but here's what's happening in LA, he said. Until 6 weeks ago, I used to drive for Lyft. Uber offered me $2,000 to switch from Lyft. Now Lyft is offering me $2,500 to switch back. I feel like a free agent without a contract. And basically, he said, I would be surprised if after all of this back and forth, Uber ended up keeping more than 7 or 8% of their fare, not 20%. You know what? 3 years later, Uber leaked out that their contribution margin in their big cities was closer to 7 to 8%. I almost wrote to them and said, hey, you know what? I learned this 3 years ago by talking to your drivers in LA. As a general rule, when you value companies, you will learn more by talking to the middle level and the bottom level of the company. Talk to the janitor, talk to the mailroom guy in the company, then you will talk to top management. I have never talked to top management when I value a company. And the reason is you get public relations, you get spin. You learn more about how a company is operating and what's going on by going into the storeroom and checking the inventory or talking to somebody who does it and say, what's going on here? So I learned about the company because I kept the door open. Incidentally, one of the questions that I got in the chat was, how do I get the reinvestment part again? Basically, I take the change in revenues every year and divide by five. Because remember, the sales to capital ratio of five means that for every dollar of capital I invest, I get $5 in revenue. So if you go back and check that spreadsheet, you take the change in revenues every year, divide by five, you should have the reinvestment that year. Very simple. But with young companies, keep it simple. Now, all of this feedback came to fruition for me while I was sitting in Munich Airport waiting for a connecting flight. This was about 4 weeks after I'd written my post. So I'm sitting in Munich Airport waiting for a connecting flight. The flight is delayed and I start checking my email. And in my emails, there's an email from a guy called Bill Gurley. For those of you who don't know Bill, Bill is a partner at Benchmark Capital. And Benchmark Capital was one of the first VCs to invest in Uber. They invested at $1 billion valuation. Bill Gurley sat on Uber's board, and he was rumored to be the person closest to Travis Kalanick, who was the CEO of Uber. So there's an email from Bill. So let me ask you a question. Do you think Bill Gurley knows more about Uber than I do? Of course. So I open the email, and here's how it begins. You know, it says, look, I read your blog post on Uber, and I did not like it. I say, we got that out of the way. And then he said, I've written my own blog post to counter your blog post. It's blog post to blog post warfare, very high tech. And he said, I've said some mean things about you and I just wanted to let you know. I said, okay. Sincerely, Bill. And that's the end of the email. So I close the email and guess where I go next? I have an hour and a half left my flight. I went to Bill's blog. It's called Above the Crowd. The guy, Bill's 6 feet, 6 inches, so above the crowd. And the very first post says, Demodarin misses by a mile. And he proceeded to take issue with every part of my story. He said, Uber is not just a car service company. It's a logistics company. Notice how words have consequences. When you describe a company as a logistics company, here's what businesses it's in. It's in the ride sharing business, the moving business, the delivery business. He said, we're not just urban. We're everywhere. We're going to be suburban. We're going to be rural. And then he said something very interesting. He said, we're trying to connect with credit card companies and with airlines. So when you make your airline reservation to fly from New York to Jakarta on United, right after you make that reservation, there's going to be a little box that says, do you want an Uber car waiting for you in Jakarta? A very interesting, creative way of converting what are local networking benefits, Uber being the largest ride-sharing company in New York, into global networking benefits. He thought I was going to be pissed off because he took multiple swipes at me through the post. But I wasn't pissed off. I was fascinated by his story. So after I read his story, I emailed him and said, Bill, would you like me to put a number on your story? Okay. He said, what are you talking about? I said, you've told a great story about Uber, but I can convert it into a value. He said, be my guest. Here I am still sitting in Munich Airport. I go into my spreadsheet and change two big numbers. The first is instead of my total market being the 100 billion, the urban car service market, I make it the logistics market, 300 billion. Instead of giving Uber a 10% market share, I give them a 40% market share. That's a local networking benefit translated into a global networking benefit. With those two changes, leaving everything else unchanged, I get a $53.4 billion value for Uber. I sent this to Bill and I said, do you like this more? He said, a lot. And he said, wait, the 20% market share is not long for, it's going to change, it's going to drop. And I almost told him, your Uber driver in LA told me that already. And he said, it'll drop to about 10%. I put in the 10% share of the fare from 20 to 10. That reduces the value from 53 to 29 billion. You're saying, how can the same company be worth $6 billion, $29 billion, or $53 billion? Let's be quite clear. There is a value out there. None of us knows it. But depending on how you frame the story, you can get very different valuations for this company. And to show you how much the story can affect value, in December of 2014, and this is still on my blog, you can go check it out, I wrote an Uber post where I said, look, guys, instead of getting pissed off at me because you don't like my story, why don't you tell me your story for Uber? So in my post, I let people pick their story for Uber. So first I said, tell me what kind of business they're in. Are they in car services, in transportation, in logistics? You know, are they, do they increase the market share by 5%? So basically I let people pick each part of the story. And then at the end of the process, I came up with the value given the story choices that people pick. And guess what? The value that I got ranged anywhere from less than $1 billion if Uber is just another car service company with no growth effects and no network effect and no competitive advantages, to more than $90 billion if it's a mobility services business, which is this very broad transportation company, which doubles the market size, has strong global networking benefits, and its competitive advantages are not going to go away. Essentially, my point was not to show that anything goes, but to show that when you disagree about the value of a young company, your disagreement is not about the revenue growth rate, it's about the story. So if you tell me that Zoom is worth three times what I think it's worth, I'm not going to fight you on the growth rate. I'm going to ask you what story you're telling about Zoom that allows them to have $35 billion in revenues in year 10. What are they going to be able to do beyond online business? Because it can't just be online business meetings then. That's going to allow them. Maybe they're going to become part of the education business, and that's where you see them going. But our discussion should be about stories because it's a healthy discussion. Whereas if you talk about percentage numbers, you end up losing sight of what the exact story is that's driving those differences. So let me take a pause there and make sure there are no questions that have come up so far. Because at this stage, we've essentially told a story, checked the story, converted the story into numbers, the numbers into a valuation, and essentially kept the feedback loop open long enough that we can finesse or even improve or change our stories. Any questions? And you can unmute yourself and ask a question if you want. You don't have to do it in the chat.
I was curious, since the valuation is so contingent on all these aspects of the story, do you ever do like a football field or some kind of graph that shows?
Never. Because I'll tell you why I find this. Because in a sense, these stories are inconsistent with each other. You can't say, well, I'm telling this story and I'm telling this story. You have to pick a story and you have to make a judgment based on it. You know why people create these football fields and all this crap? It's because it allows them to cover their rear end. I hate it when banks provide that, you know, the value could be 20 to 113. Hey, you know what? That might be great for you to cover your rear end, but I have to buy at a price. So I think we all need to make judgment calls. And that judgment call will lead you to believing one part of the story is more likely than others. And you know what? Pick a story. You will be wrong. Come back and revisit that story. I think that's a much healthier way to do this than to allow all those stories to keep brewing as you think about investing.
Hi, Professor. So when, for example, in Uber, now it's $47 billion market cap. So when you valued companies and after a couple of years, let's say the value of the company is different, how have you found that if that's the case, then you have been wrong on story or the story?
Oh, absolutely. Right? In fact, that's what we're going to talk about next. I am hopelessly wrong. You know why? The world changes. The story you told about your company 6 weeks ago, I don't care what company it is. You think you can tell the same story today? I mean, what's the last 6 weeks, in a sense, has changed every one of our stories. There's a macro shock like none we've ever seen before in history. Every one of our stories is wrong. But before you beat yourself up for not seeing this coming, hey, guess what? Nobody saw it coming. The prices, the market is just as much in shock as you are. And that's the thing to remember. When you change your story before you beat yourself up, but this is a dynamic process and you have to revisit that story and think about what you can do differently.
But have you found yourself that you are right on the story, but maybe wrong on the numbers sometimes?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I'm going to talk about different ways in which you might revisit your story. Your basic story might be right, but your contours for the story might shift. Your basic story can be wrong, in which case you get to revisit the story itself. So there are lots of ways in which your story can change. And most of the time, my basic story stays intact, but I will have to adjust the story based on what I'm learning about the company. And I'll give examples of that. Any other questions? There was actually a question in the chat, which means when you start a valuation, you have to start with the story. I think so. The more mature a company, the more you can get away just starting with the numbers. So if you're valuing a Kraft Heinz or a Coca-Cola, think of yourself as being in chapter 33 of a 35 chapter book. There's not a whole lot of storytelling left. But if you're valuing a Casper or a Zoom, the story is just beginning. You have to start with the story before you start putting the numbers in. Okay, so here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about why stories might break, why stories might shift, and why stories might change. Let's start with story breaks, because that's the most dramatic thing that can happen to your story, which is you're telling a story, and then suddenly you realize the story doesn't work anymore. I'll give you a couple of examples. Let's say you're valuing a young biotechnology company with a blockbuster drug working its way through the pipeline. And you tell the story, an incredibly optimistic, ambitious story about this blockbuster drug making its way through the pipeline, becoming a billion-dollar drug, and you build a valuation on it. And the next day, you open up your newspaper, and you see a news story that in the most recent test on the drug, three people who took the drug had serious health problems, and the company has suspended testing the drug. Hey, your story's just broken. You got to go back and rethink your story. And I'll give you a kind of a crazy version of the story. You know, with Tesla, remember that story I told about Tesla at the start of the year? And one of the things about Tesla that makes it interesting is not only is this expanding, difficult to tell story, but it's a company where the story of the company and the story of a person are tied together. You know the person I'm talking about. Tesla and Elon Musk are kind of tied at the hip. So the story of Tesla you tell is also a story of Elon Musk. Okay? So you tell this, let's say, ambitious story about Tesla becoming this auto tech company, and you come up with $700 per share. And you go to sleep, you know, saying, I've got a good story for Tesla. I feel pretty comfortable. The next morning you wake up and there's a new story. And here's what it says. Elon Musk enters rehab. Now, let me ask you a question. Would any of you be shocked if you saw a story like that? I wouldn't be. I mean, Elon Musk strikes me as the kind of person who might have to go into rehab, even if he's doing really well as a business person. He strikes me as, you know, potentially on the edge. Think of what will happen if Elon Musk goes into rehab to your Tesla story. So when you think about a story, sometimes stories can break because there's the company's so bound up with the founder and something bad happens to the founder. Sometimes stories can break because of external events. So when a story breaks, here's what you need to do. You need to say, look, I was wrong and I'm going to start from scratch again. When Travis was forced out of Uber, I had to think about whether this was a story break or a story change. Because if Uber and Travis had been so connected at the hip that when he went down, Uber went down with it, my story would have broken. I had to think about it before I decided the story hadn't broken. So that's the first possibility. Something forces your story to break and you got to tell a new story. The second is your story stays the same. And this was the question that Shashanka had a question about, but the contour shift. Now, if you look at Apple, a company I valued every year for the last decade on my blog, the basic story I've told about Apple has stayed pretty much the same over the last 10 years. I describe Apple as a smartphone company. It's really not a tech company or a computer company. It's a smartphone company. The iPhone is 75% of Apple's revenues, earnings, and cash flows. It's a smartphone company with potentially low growth. The market's getting pretty saturated, but it's a cash machine. Smartphone company with slow growth and a huge cash machine. That was a story I told in 2012. That's a story I've told in 2020. But that doesn't mean my value doesn't change, because there are things that have happened in Apple that have caused my story to shift. I'll tell you one of the things that caused my story to shift in the optimistic side was when Apple services started to become a moneymaker. So it's a services business on the side. It's a huge margin business. That was a story shift. It's not a story change, because I don't think Apple services will rescue Apple if the iPhone collapses. It's still an iPhone company, but that's my basic story stayed the same. But as facts come in, I could change aspects of the story. So that's a story shift. Let's talk about story changes. Let's say your company does something you did not expect it to do. You never saw that coming. So let's say, you know, I take Facebook. Let me make this personal again. I valued Facebook, and I valued it as an online advertising juggernaut. It and Google are taking over the online advertising world, and that's the way I valued Facebook, as an online advertising company. Let's say next quarter, Facebook reports that for the first time, it's opened a Facebook retail store, and 6% of its revenues are coming from the retail store, and it's making a 20% margin. I never saw that coming. You know what I'd have to do? I'd have to revisit my story and reflect the change in my story. So stories can break, stories can shift, and stories can change. And I'll tell you the three most freeing words when you're valuing companies and investing is saying, I was wrong. Because if you're unwilling to say that, you're going to stay stuck on a story even as the world shifts under you. And with Uber, I showed you my valuation in June of 2014. You know what? I valued Uber every year since on my blog. Go look at my Uber story in 2015, 2016, 2017, 2018, at the time of their IPO. My story's changed. The biggest change actually happened between 2014 and 15. And I'll tell you what triggered that change. And it's going to give you an insight into how small events can cause changes. So if you remember in June of 2014, the story I told for Uber was, it's an urban car service company that'll attract new users. But the new users I saw them attracting were people like my son and my niece, 20, 25 year olds, who are basically much more comfortable with smartphones and therefore use Uber. So that was my valuation, $6 billion. So towards the end of that year, I visit the place I grew up in India, Chennai, where my parents still lived. And for those of you who don't know much about India, the part of India that I grew up in, Chennai, is the most conservative part of India, where things haven't changed very much for hundreds of years in terms of how people approach things. And my mother is a very conservative Indian woman. So her version of car service when I was growing up was to open the window upstairs and yell, "Driver, bring the car to the front." That was car service for her. So I visit her at the end of 2014, and now we're going to go out somewhere. And I noticed she's got a smartphone out. And I'm already impressed that she has a smartphone. And she's hitting the smartphone. I said, "Mom, what are you doing?" And she said, "I'm calling Uber." And I said, "You use Uber?" She says, "All the time. It's so easy to use." And I knew right then that I'd got my Uber valuation all wrong. If people like my mother are using Uber, then I've completely underestimated how many new users Uber was going to attract. So when I got home that evening, I revalued Uber, allowing for a 20% growth in the car service business, which makes the car service business huge relative to what my original estimate was. It increased my value of Uber from 6 billion to about 25 billion. But basically my point is, be open to cues around you. It doesn't have to show up in numbers. You don't have to wait for the company to report things for your story to change. You have to kind of be willing to be open to feedback you get from all around you. Okay? One more example of feedback you can get is basically it can come from earnings reports. I'm going to send you a link on how I read earnings reports. Because when I see earnings reports, I don't focus on earnings per share surprises, because the young companies, who cares? I'm looking for changes in my story that can come from the earnings report. I want to kind of deal with one of the questions that's come on the chat is, can you have two or three narratives going? Yes, but at some point in time, you got to have a dominant narrative. You can't, because you're making an investment decision today. So you have to have a dominant narrative, and you can keep the door open to other narratives where you look for facts and say, maybe I should go for another one. But basically, it's something that you have to think about. One final question I've been asked is, in my Uber 2019 valuation, am I thinking of Uber as a logistics company? I still think Uber is primarily a car service company. I know Uber Freight is a promising business, but I think that the heart of Uber is still Uber car service. Even Uber Eats, I think, is a side business. I think car service will remain the central part of Uber. And Dara Khosrowshahi last year, when he talked about what Uber needed to do to become profitable, recognized that. He said, look, we've got to take care of our car service business. That's the heart of our business. So I think it's still a car service business with the potential for other logistics on the side, but car service is going to stay its central story. Any questions on the storytelling? To me, storytelling makes valuation fun. It's not, so you're no longer an Excel ninja. You're thinking about connect. It can, you know, remember I said, you can be a storyteller and number crunch. It allows you to bring both sides of your brain, left brain and right brain, into the valuation. I'm having a tough time because there are so many things coming in the chat. If you have a question, in fact, why don't you unmute yourself and actually ask me the question? It'll be easier before we move on. Question. So any questions before we go on?
Question.
Yep.
Go ahead. You are putting the probability of default at 0.1,
yeah,
was that already not factored in the 12% interest?
No, that's exactly the problem. Remember, when you do cost of capital take care of uncertainty about cash flows over time. They don't take into account truncation risk. That's why when you value Boeing and you compute a cost of capital, your cost of capital is still going to be low for Boeing, notwithstanding the fact that you're worried that they might not make it. That's why you have to bring in a likelihood of failure after your DCF, because a discount rate is a blunt instrument. It was never designed to carry the risk of not making it. VCs make this mistake by trying to hike up their discount rate for young startups. You can't do that. A DCF, a discount rate is really a discount rate that reflects your risk as a going concern. This is the risk. You will not be a going concern. It has to be explicitly brought in from outside.
Just on that, wouldn't you say that in the cost of debt, because there's an additional amount of spread that we add to the risk-free rate, that has in it embedded the default risk?
Only very mildly, and here's why. The way we come up with the default spread on a cost for a bond is we assume you'll make the promised payments over time, and then you look at the price today. So even when you use a default spread, you're implicitly assuming you're going to make the coupon payments and the face value. So a default spread, you know, and you can try this out. Take a company in deep distress, try to compute its cost of capital. Okay? Do all the traditional cost of capital calculation. You're not going to see your cost of capital go through the roof because you're going to see offsetting effects. Okay? So I don't think a cost of debt is going to carry that weight. No? And if you're worried about double counting, just use a healthy company's cost of capital and bring in the distress probability separately. But I don't think either the cost of debt or the cost of capital is going to be a good mechanism for conveying worries about distress and not making it. Any other questions? Go ahead, Sammy. You're muted. I can't hear you. Okay, there you go. Go ahead.
Okay. First of all, hi. Just my question is, when we're talking about stories and competition, would we consider competition just the idea?
Let me turn it back on you. Which of all, remember, I used four levers for Uber, right? I had revenue growth, I had a market share, I had margins, and I had reinvestment. If you're worried about a sector being competitive, which of those four numbers do you think is best going to reflect it? You have a competitive sector.
And I can choose more than one.
You can use more than one. You can have lower revenue growth, perhaps because you have more competition. Or if you're willing to cut prices to keep the competition out, you're going to have lower margins. So that combination of revenue growth and margins you use is going to reflect the competition you think the company will face. In the case of Uber, I used a combination of high revenue growth and high margins. Implicitly, the story I'm telling about Uber is there's going to be relatively little competition. If I thought competition was going to be intense, both those numbers would have to get lower.
Okay, understood. Thanks.
Okay. Any final questions? Okay, so let's start to actually do some valuations. We're halfway through the semester. You know what? I haven't valued a single company yet. So I'm going to start to do some valuations. And as I go through these valuations, what I'm going to do is I'm going to be using equity risk premiums in each of the valuations. Rather than try to explain where the risk premium comes in each valuation, I wanted to kind of list where they're going to come from before I started to save myself the time. If you see any valuations from before 1998 in the next few pages, and I don't think you will, but if you do, you're going to see a 5.5% premium. I used to use a historical risk premium pre-1998, the old world, and that's where the 5.5% came from. Between 98 and 2008, I shift to an implied equity risk premium. And you're going to see a lot of 4% equity risk premium because that was implied equity risk premium for much of that period. Post 2008, you'd have seen, especially in 2009, you're going to see a 6.5% premium. Why? Because the crisis in 2008 pushed up the equity risk premium. And actually, that's a good time for me to tell you that I'm working on updating the equity risk premium pages, not just for the US, but the country risk premiums. So by the, I think by April 1st, I'll have updated numbers. You don't have to wait to do that. Wait to do your valuation until that comes out. But be aware that I'm going to update these numbers because let's face it, the last 6 weeks have pushed up risk premiums across the board. And after 2009, any company's valuation will reflect the implied equity risk premium the month in which I did that valuation. So that's where the equity risk premiums come from in these valuations. So let's, and the way I'm going to present each valuation is I'm going to, with each company that I value, I'm going to set up my valuation with a story, kind of keeping true to my notion of stories drive valuations. And with every valuation, I'm going to focus on one aspect of the valuation rather than go through every single detail. That's partly to prevent boring you to death, because if I take every detail and work it through, we could be spending the rest of eternity here and you're going to be completely bored. I'm going to pick one aspect in each valuation that I think is different about it and focus my attention on it. So you ready? Let's get started. We're going to start with a very easy valuation, at least in hindsight. This was a valuation I did of Con Ed in August of 2008. For those of you not familiar with Con Ed is a regulated utility. If you're not familiar with regulated utilities, they're basically power companies and water companies and other utilities in the US which have a monopoly. But in return for getting a monopoly, these companies have lost pricing power. So they have to go to a regulatory commission, which lets them, which would tell them this is how much you can raise the price of power this year. So these are regulated utilities, a monopoly. So the revenues are pretty predictable because they provide something that's non-discretionary, power or water. And because their pricing power is taken away, they can't grow at 15% a year, their earnings. Their earnings are kind of constrained because the regulatory authority basically determines pricing. So I'm going to value train Con Ed using a stable growth dividend discount model. This is the simplest conceivable model you can use in valuation. And I'll explain why I used a stable growth dividend discount model. I use stable growth because it's a regulated utility. It serves New York City and its environs. This is a mature part of the country. You don't have population growing 10% a year. The power consumption is growing 1%, 2% a year. So I assume that their growth rate would be close to the growth rate of, you know, pretty close to inflation rate. So I've set the growth rate at 2%, around 2% a year forever. I'm going to focus on equity because this company's debt ratio has been pretty stable for about 30 years. And finally, this is a company that pays out almost its entire free cash flow equity as dividends. Remember, there are two ways you can value equity. You can look at what a company can potentially pay out, which is free cash flow equity, what they actually pay out, which is dividends. Then dividends are almost their free cash flow equity. So they fit all the requirements for a stable growth dividend discount model. And this makes my life really simple. Because think of what you need to value a company with a stable growth dividend discount model. You need expected dividends next year. You need a cost of equity and you need a growth rate forever. Let me piece by piece go through each of these components. Last year, the year leading into the 2008 valuation, Con Ed had earnings per share of $3.17 and paid out $2.32 as dividends. In other words, it paid 73% of its earnings as dividends, which actually is one of the tests I run when I have a stable growth company. Is it paying out a big chunk of its earnings as cash flows? It is. If you take its retention ratio, which is 27%, and the return on equity it had as a company, its expected growth rate, remember that simple equation for growth, return equity times retention ratio? The growth rate is about 2.1%, which is well below the risk-free rate. So it fits the needs for, is it a stable growth rate? So it's paying out companies like a stable company. Its growth rate is that of a stable growth company. Here's what I did. I assumed dividends would continue to grow 2.1% a year forever. So I take the dividends from last year, $2.32. I grow out those dividends at 2.1%. That gives me expected dividend next year. And you always have to do this in the present value model. And I divided it by the cost of equity for Con Ed. Let me explain where the cost of equity came from. The T-bond rate then was 4.1%, different age. The beta that I used was a bottom-up beta, 0.80. And the equity risk premium in August of 2008, this is just before the storm hit in the form of a crisis, was 4.5%. 4.1% plus beta times risk premium is 7.7%. So I take the 232, grow it out 1 year, and divide by cost of equity, 7.7% minus the growth rate forever, 2.1%, I get a value per share of $42.30. If you look at the stock price was $40.76. The stock is mildly undervalued, very mildly undervalued. I'm not going to do something crazy and go load up on the stock. It's not undervalued enough. But based on my inputs, the stock looks mildly undervalued. So the story I'm telling is of a mature company growing at a rate well below the growth rate of the economy, paying out a big chunk of its earnings as dividends and continuing to do so. And the value that I get with that story is $42.30. Any questions on the mechanics of what I did?
I was wondering, do you ever do like a sensitivity analysis? Like you chose a growth rate of 2.1.
You're exactly one page ahead because that's exactly what I did. Right. So don't apologize. That's good you're thinking ahead because you're saying I've made some assumptions. In this case, a 2.1% growth rate assumption. What if I'm wrong? A good always ask, right? When you do a growth rate in, you come up with a value that's different from the price. Before you jump in, you want to ask, what if I'm wrong? And one simple way to ask what if you're wrong is to look what rate you would need to get to the current stock price. Do you see what I'm trying to do? I have a 2.1% growth rate. I'm getting 42.30. The stock price is only 40.76. What would the growth rate need to be to get 40.76? That's what I'm solving for in this graph. And I get about 2%. So here's what I have. I'm estimating 2.1%. The market is imputing 2%. Am I going to jump in? Not really. The numbers are so close. I'm going to say, look, I'm pretty close to the market's numbers. I'm just going to move on. I'll tell you when this might lead you to action. Let's say you have a company where you've used a 15% growth rate. You come up with the value for the company, and the value is much higher than the price. You're getting ready to buy. But before you buy, you go check what growth rate is implied in the market price. And the market is implying a 7% growth rate. Remember, you used a 15% growth rate. The market is suggesting a 7% growth rate. You at least have to stop and ask, what is the market seeing that I'm not? Maybe it's seeing nothing. Maybe the market's just wrong. But it's a good way of asking that what if question is, what if I'm wrong, is to look at what growth rate you're using versus that imputed growth rate. Incidentally, if you have in an Excel spreadsheet, the easiest way to do this is to use the solver function in Excel and solve for the growth rate that makes the value per share equal to the market price. So it's a very simple exercise. And in fact, I'll send you an email, follow-up email that shows you how to do this. But it's a good way of asking how much buffer do I have in my valuation. Any other questions? Yeah, go ahead.
Yes. Can you go to the previous slide?
Yep.
So can you briefly just explain how did we come up with a 2.1 growth rate?
Well, if you look at towards the top, it's a retention. Remember, retention ratio times return on equity is expected growth rate. It's that fundamental growth equation that we used at the very. So, if you review your growth notes, if you're in steady state, which I'm assuming Con Ed is in, your return on equity times your retention ratio should give you your expected growth rate. So, 27% of 7.7% should be 2.1%.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Okay. So this process of solving for an implied number there's a book written based on this approach called Expectations Investing. It's written by one of my favorite people in finance, Mike Mabusin, who I think writes some incredibly creative stuff on finance, and Al Rappaport, who I also admire for kind of being one of the pioneers in value, in thinking about where does value come from. That entire book is built on, can we solve from the market price what the market is believing about the future? It's actually a good technique for you to get comfortable with your own valuation. Okay. Any other questions? There are no other questions. Let's keep moving on. So let's see where we are. I have a value per share. And when you do a discounted cash flow valuation, the value per share you get is as of today, right? $42.30. But if you're ever, if you ever read an equity research report, in most equity research reports, they don't talk about a value today. They give you a target price 1 year from now. So let me put you in the role of an equity research analyst, and I'd like something, you know, I'd like you to react to it. Okay. I've come up with a value per share of 42.30. Let's say you agree with that value. I've used a cost of equity of 7.7%. Let's say you agree with that cost of equity. And I've given you my expected dividends next year, which is $2.32, growing at 2%, which is about, what, $2.38 or $2.40. Can you use those three pieces of information, the value per share, the cost of equity, and the expected dividend next year, to tell me what the target price will be? If you're an equity research analyst, what target price you would have 1 year from now? Anybody have any ideas how you'd combine those three numbers to come up with the target price next year?
I can give it a shot.
I'm sorry?
Go ahead. I could give it a shot.
Go ahead.
Valuation on today multiplied by 1.077, which is
okay,
the equity,
right?
And then reduce it by the dividend, and that should be the price of any other option market.
And if I wanted to get a target price 5 years from now, what would you do?
Maybe compound that.
Exactly.
And then also compound the dividends and growth.
Yeah. You could impress people. You could give them target prices in 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. And let's see the intuition as to why that worked. When I value the share at 42.30, I'm basically saying that's a fair value, right? And if you're at fair value, you know what you're going to earn as an equity investor? You're going to earn your cost of equity. That's why we will multiply by 1.077. That's a 7.7% cost of equity. But remember, when we talked about cost of equity, we said some of it comes from dividends and some of it from price appreciation. So that's why we're subtracting out the dividend part. Say the portion that's price appreciation is whatever's the difference is between what I get as my expected price minus the dividends. So to get the target price 1 year from now, I'm going to take 42.30 times 1.077. That's a 7.7% cost of equity minus the expected dividends next year. And if you bought the stock today at 40.76, which is the actual stock price, you could take your expected target price 1 year from now and actually compute what return you'd make, and you'd make well over 7.7%. That's the definition of an undervalued stock, is you make more than your cost of equity. So it's actually a very neat trick for you to convert a discounted cash flow valuation to target prices if that's what the person you're talking to relates to more. Any questions about target prices? So the question was, why we're multiplying 42 by 3 by the cost of equity? Essentially, if you're fairly valued, that's what you will earn as a return on your stock, is your cost of equity. So that's why we multiply by the cost of equity. Okay, so if there are no questions, I'm going to move to my second valuation. This is actually going to be relevant for some of you because it's a valuation I did of 3M on September 12th of 2008. For those of you who don't remember September 12th of 2008, most of you are too young to remember. It was I call it my last day of innocence. It was a day before the banking crisis hit. In fact, it was that Friday that Lehman went bankrupt, and then Monday we woke up to a storm. So this was a pre-crisis valuation. So it's valuing a mature company, or a company that's pretty set in its ways, in what I thought was a mature economy. So I did my valuation, and I go through what the pieces of this valuation. Again, because it's a company that settled down, I could use that fundamental growth equation. Remember the fundamental growth equation of reinvestment rate times return on capital, or return on equity times return retention ratio, works only if your company settled in. Its margins are stable. And I assume 3M's margins were pretty stable. And in 2008, before the crisis hit, their reinvestment rate was about 30%, pretty close to what it was last year. Yeah? So I looked at the last year's numbers. And its return on capital was about 25%. I assumed they could keep doing what they were doing. If you reinvest 30% and your return on capital is 25%, your expected growth rate is the product of those two numbers, which gives me 7.5% growth. So my growth rate reflects fundamentals and the assumption that margins are stable. So implicitly, I'm telling you a story about a company that's growing but is in steady state. After the fifth year, I assume they become a mature company and I give them a 3% growth rate. Why am I able to get away with the 3% growth rate? Because if you look at the T-bond rate on that day, it was 3.72%. The growth rate is less than the risk-free rate. I'm at least following my own rules. I did assume that after year five, 3M's competitive advantages would fade pretty quickly. So the return on capital becomes equal to the cost of capital. The way this shows up is if you look at the return on capital in that last box, in the stable growth box, it's 6.76%, said equal to my cost of capital. You're saying, why do you care about the return on capital after year five? Well, to grow 3% a year with a 6.76% return on capital, I will need to reinvest about 44% of my after-tax operating income every year in perpetuity. So I have a two-stage model. For the first 5 years, they're able to earn well above their cost of capital and grow 7.5% a year and reinvest 30%. After year five, their competitive advantages disappear and their return on capital drops the cost of capital. They're growing 3% a year and reinvesting about 44%. I'm ready to do my valuation. Here's what I did. For the first 5 years, I grow my after-tax operating income 7.5% a year. I subtract out 30% of that after-tax operating income every year to get to reinvestment. And that gives me my free cash flow to the firm. This is a cash-rich company. Its free cash flow to the firm are already positive. After year five, I stop giving them excess returns. I adjust my growth rate down, my reinvestment rate to 44%. That gives me my cash flow in year six. I always have to do my cash flow in year six. If you look at the 2,645, it's lower than my year five number because I have to reinvest more in steady state. I take my cash flow in year six and I divide by the difference between the cost of capital and the growth rate. To get to my cost of capital, for my first 5 years, I do it the long way. I start with the risk-free rate, which is 3.72%. To get my cost of debt, I had a default spread based on 3M's rating. That's what made this valuation easy. Mature company, it has a bond rating. I multiply by 1 minus the marginal tax rate, which in 2008 in the US was 35%. Gives me an after-tax cost of debt of 2.91%. To get my cost of equity, I start with the same risk-free rate. My beta is a bottom-up beta reflecting the businesses 3M was in. And my implied equity risk premium on September 12th of 2008 was 4%. You're going to see how wrong I was 3 days later, but that's after the fact. You take the cost of equity and the cost of debt, and you take the weights, which in 2008 for 3M was 92% equity, market value, and 8% debt. I come up with a cost of capital of 7.88%. If you look at what happens after year five and why my cost of capital drops, I did assume that by the end of year five, as a mature company, 3M would borrow more money. I used a higher debt ratio. And that higher debt ratio, in conjunction with my beta moving towards one, I moved the beta, I think, from 1.15 down to 1.1, gave me a lower cost of capital. Don't overthink this. If you don't want to explicitly estimate a cost of capital in your terminal growth, just use the median cost of capital for all companies. For Uber, if you remember, I moved my cost of capital to 8%. I have everything I need, including my terminal value. I discount all my numbers back. Let me explain what I mean by that. I discount my year one cash flow, 1 year at 7.88%. My year two, 2 years at 7.88%. My year five, 5 years at 7.88%. And don't forget that I have $70.4 billion in my terminal value. My terminal value is at the end of year five. I discount that terminal value back to today as well at 7.88%, not at 6.76%. I get the terminal value using 6.76%, but I have to live through the next 5 years to get to the terminal value. So I discount back at the cost of capital of my high growth period. What I get as a present value is $60.6 billion for the operating assets. I add cash. I subtract out debt. Thank God 3M did not have cross holdings or I have to deal with that nightmare. I come up with a value of equity of $58.4 billion. Divide by the number of shares, I get $84 per share. The stock was actually trading at $70 per share. I remember doing this. It was actually midday on Friday. And I said, I should buy the shares. I was in New York. Right? I should buy the shares. I said, I'll do it after I send some emails out. I completely forgot to buy the shares. Best decision I ever made. Because over the weekend, the world shifted under me. You had, of course, Lehman go under. And Monday, of course, we woke up to the crisis. So this is 6 weeks later, 5 weeks into that crisis. The world has shifted under me. I mean, as I sit through the coronavirus scare in markets, I get a sense of deja vu because I remember people being completely unsettled. after the 2008 crisis. So this is 5 weeks later. There's been no new information from 3M because the next earnings report is not coming out till November or December. The numbers for 3M themselves haven't changed. But I revalued 3M. You're saying, what could have changed? The numbers haven't changed. The value shouldn't change. Hey, you could world shifting and you, how can the value not change? And the biggest change was actually not at the company level, but at the macro level. So let me start with the biggest changes I made. Remember the default spread and the equity risk premium I used just 5 weeks prior? This is 5 weeks later. Look at what happened to the default spread. 3M's rating hadn't changed, but the default spreads had doubled over those 5 weeks. Very similar to what's happened in the last 5 weeks with spreads and equity risk premiums in the US, is the spread had gone from 0.75 to 1.5%, which means my after-tax cost of debt was 3.55%. The risk-free rate had actually crept up a little bit and then dropped off to 2% by the end of the year. So my cost of debt went up from 2.91% to 3.55%. Remember that 4% equity risk premium I was using 4 weeks ago? My implied equity risk premium, and this is why it's so critical to have forward-looking dynamic premiums, had jumped to 6%. Why? Because there's a crisis going on. That 6% higher risk premium increases my cost of equity. Overall, my cost of capital has gone up to 10.3%. And I wager that for many of your companies, this change is what you're going to see. If you'd computed your cost of capital, if you'd done everything I asked you to do on time, you're going to look back and say, that was too low. Be willing to revisit those numbers. In fact, don't even be willing. You absolutely have to revisit those numbers with updated premiums. And I have a much higher cost of capital. I've also become more pessimistic about the economy. And you know why this shows up? I give 3M a lower return on capital and a lower reinvestment rate. How much lower? It's a completely subjective judgment. I felt that the economy looking forward, even long term, was going to feel the pain for a lot longer. So my growth going forward, instead of being 7.5%, is now 5%. In fact, if I wanted to, I could have had a 1 year shock where in year one, I had a drop in earnings and then the growth rate. So in fact, you can have your own devices for bringing in the effect into the cash flows of the crisis. But the value that I got for 3M with the changes, higher cost of capital, lower growth rate, was $61. Remember, it was $84 6 weeks ago. Do I feel uncomfortable that the value has changed so much in 5 weeks? I'd feel uncomfortable if the value hadn't changed at least this much after a crisis. But look at what happened to the stock price. It went from 70 to 57. The stock went from being undervalued to fairly valued. And I got down and I said, thank you, God, for giving me procrastination. Because if I bought the stock at 70, I'd have lost about 20% of my value. So as you value your company today, don't reinvent the wheel. The company is still the company, but ask yourself, what will the crisis do? And in fact, I'm working on a coronavirus version of my free cash flow Ginzu model, which allows you to input what you think the effect will be on 2020. Because the big change in many of your companies is your earnings and revenues this year are going to take a huge hit. And it lets you input that number. And then go back to what you think will be steady state for your company in the post-virus economy. But you have to start thinking about that when you value companies. So I went through a lot. So I'm going to pause and ask for questions on the crisis and how you bring it in and the 3M valuation. So any questions? Go ahead.
The debt that's subtracted is the market value of debt, right?
Yeah. It's a market value of debt. So for some of you, if your debt has become riskier, the market value of your debt could actually decrease after a crisis, right? Because the crisis raises the cost of debt, increases distress risk. So your market value of debt could get lower after a crisis. Boeing's debt has lost 10% of its market value. The $28 billion in market value terms is now down to $25 billion. But it's not good news because the entire company has been hit. Any other questions?
This is not particularly related to this particular, but what is like the median or average return on capital across US companies? Isn't 20% like too?
Oh, no. Median return on capital is, it's not the median, the weighted return on capital. 60% of US companies have returns on capital that are less than the cost of capital. They're in the single digits. But if you weighted by size, I think the return on capital last year was about 10.5%, 11%. For a US company. Global company, it's about 9.5%. 3M is special because it's got, you know, it's got this neat, it sells you stuff like the 3M post-it note, right? And right now, one of the things, I own 3M. It's taken quite a beating, but I heard this morning that they're quadrupling their production because they're also the producers of the N94 masks. The 3M masks are have the biggest market share. So the virus will play out in very interesting ways, many of these companies. Any other questions? One of the questions about a higher risk premium, even as prices drop. In fact, it's prices drop. It's exactly why the risk premium is going up. Because if your risk premium goes up, your price will drop. So you can, the two are connected. If I hold cash flows fixed and I lower the price, I've raised my risk premium. And why is the risk premium higher? Because we're all terrified. I mean, this comes from your gut, right? Aren't you more scared today than you were 5 weeks ago about your investing? You should be. That's why risk premiums go up. Any other questions?
Professor. So what do you do in situations where the market has changed so drastically that what you kind of previously had as your implied risk premium is so drastically different?
Exactly why I'm updating my implied equity risk premiums is you have to update it to reflect where the market is today. You might then take a point of view of what will happen to that risk premium over time. Because remember, you have that option of revisiting your cost of capital. So you might say, look, I'm in a crisis. I'm going to use a 7% risk premium. We're close to that right now in US equities. I'm going to use a 7% equity risk premium for the near term, but then I'm going to lower that risk premium down to a 5%, which I think is a premium for the long term. So you can have your cake and eat it too. You can adjust your premium to reflect the implied premium today, but you can also have a long-term view on that implied premium.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, so I'm going to close today with something that is going to be kind of, you're going to look at it and say, what a stupid idiot. At the start of this year, I wanted to value the S&P 500. Remember, you can value an index just like you do a stock. So here's what I did. Initially, I did a dividend discount model valuation of the S&P 500. So I took the dividends last year. I applied the analyst estimate of growth to it. I discounted all back at a cost of equity. And the cost of equity for the S&P 500 is just the risk-free rate plus the equity risk premium. The beta for the S&P 500 is close to 1. So I took the dividends, discounted them back at 6.92%. Beyond year 5, I assumed that the growth rate in dividends would converge on the growth rate for the economy. And remember, the proxy for that is the risk-free rate. So here's what I have. I had the 58.80, which was the dividends in the index, growing at 3.96% for the next 5 years, and then 1.92% thereafter, discounted back at 6.92%. It's essentially a dividend discount model valuation of the S&P 500. The value that I got was 1,312. The index was trading at 32.31. At first sight, you're saying, this is awful. Stocks are all hopelessly overvalued. In fact, if I focus just on dividends, that's exactly the conclusion I would draw. But what am I missing when I focus just on dividends in U.S. equities? What's the other way we're getting cash flows? We're getting buybacks. So in the second way, here's what I did. I took the same approach, and instead of using dividends, I used what I call augmented dividends, a fancy word for adding buybacks. There's a risk here and a danger, and I'll come and talk about it because in hindsight, we'll see what the danger is. I took the dividends and buybacks, 150.50, or used that as my cash flow instead of the dividends. And the value that I got was 33.57, which means the index is pretty close to fairly valued. So with dividends, the index looked massively overvalued. With dividends plus buybacks, it looks actually mildly undervalued. Now, of course, one of the pushbacks I would get if I did this in an intrinsic value setting was I'm using an analyst growth rate, right? And one of the things we said about analysts is they're not that good at forecasting growth. So here's a third try. I took the 150.5, but instead of using the analyst estimate of growth, I adjusted that growth, the payout ratio to reflect the fact that at least in the long term, fundamentals have to hold. What does that mean? The amount of cash flows U.S. companies can pay out will depend on the return on equity they earn, which in 2019 was 18.44% collectively, and the growth rate you want, which is 1.92%. So what I'm doing here is starting with the same cash flow, but over time adjusting my payout ratio to reflect the fact that they have to be supported by fundamentals. The value that I get is almost exactly equal to the index. So I'll be quite honest. At the start of this year, if you'd asked me, what do you think about the market? My answer would have been pretty much the answer you'd always get about the market. I'm not a market timer, but based on the fundamentals, I can see why markets are trading where they are. That was, what, 3 months ago? Index now is at about 2450, maybe 25, depending on where the day ends up. You're saying, how do you explain what's happened? I don't have to. The world shifted under me. But you know which of these numbers is under the most assault right now? I mean, the equity risk premium obviously has gone up. The risk-free rate actually has gone down. So I don't think the cost of equity has changed that much. But which of the numbers in this valuation is the softest one, which you're going to see the biggest change in after this crisis? Buybacks, exactly. You're already starting to see companies revisit buybacks. And let's take an extreme scenario. Let's suppose every company stops buying back shares. You know what's going to happen to that cash flow? It's going to implode. Okay? I don't think that'll happen because there are going to be two forces that play out here. One is companies that shouldn't have been doing buybacks in the first place, that have a lot of debt, are in trouble, are going to stop. Boeing stopped, thank God, in 2019. But the airlines were buying back stock, that's over. Banks have stopped buying back stock. But there's another segment of companies that actually have huge cash flows, Apple, for instance, where actually you could argue that buybacks might actually increase rather than decrease. Do you see why? Because now your stock price is down 25%, 30%, 35%. So I don't think buybacks are going to go to zero, but I think you're going to see a big drop in buybacks. How much? I'll tell you what happened in 2009. 2009, buybacks dropped by 60%. I think we're going to see something similar. But here's the optimistic note. That drop in buybacks in 2009, by 2013, companies were back to buying back shares. I think buybacks are a much healthier way of returning cash than dividends, because in a year like this one, I want companies to stop paying out cash to their stockholders. Dividends are sticky. There will be a drop in dividends, but you'd be amazed at how small that drop is going to be. So today, if I revalue the S&P 500, I can't prejudge it. I'm going to try it this weekend. I'm going to use lower earnings and cash flows. I already have been doing this on my viral updates. I'm going to use lower earnings and cash flows, a higher risk premium, and I'm going to revalue the index. And let's see where it is today relative to where it's trading at. So I'm going to stop there because we've done a lot of stuff. I don't want to hit with more. We have a couple of minutes left. So if you have any questions, no, feel free to ask me now, and we have another 4 minutes. So just unmute yourself and ask me the question, because the chat box is there, but lots of things are coming. In fact, one of the questions in the chat box is, the risk-free rate is less than 1%. So what? Risk premiums have gone up. Risk-free rate is less than 1%. The risk-free rate being low is going to play out in lots of places in your valuation. It's low because there's a crisis. The same crisis is going to keep your cash flows low. Your growth is going to be low. So let it play out. Don't mess with the risk-free rate.
Hey, Professor. Yep. Is there an updated document for the risk premiums that you may have sent an email recently, or will you be providing that soon?
It's actually on the front page of my website. You'll actually see the latest month's risk premium. But the update that I'm doing for April 1st, I will send, I haven't finished, because April 1st is obviously not there. I'm collecting the data, all of the equity risk premiums, not just the U.S. I haven't updated the country equity risk premiums. In fact, that's all your spreadsheets. So there's a simplistic way of adjusting it, which is every time you adjust the base mature market premium, all the country equity risk premiums automatically adjust. But I'll have to go back and revisit those country equity risk premiums this weekend, because they're based on default spreads for countries, and those have doubled over the last 6 weeks as well.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
Any other questions?
In general, because you must have seen so many such shocks, isn't this like a better time to buy stocks?
I'm sorry, could you repeat that question?
I said, in general, I'm sure you've seen many such economic shocks.
I'm not that old.
You're 62. No, you've seen like at least four cycles.
Well, I've seen four shocks, right? I mean, when I was three years old or five years old, I wasn't watching for the shocks, unfortunately. I was more worried about now whether I was going to get my food. So basically, think of it 1980s.
Good time to buy?
Yeah. Did I buy during those shocks? I have.
No, I said, do you think generally such shocks are good time to buy? Because you said you would be more risk averse. I would believe that I'm getting like half the cushion, so good time to buy.
Remember that when you're paranoid, sometimes there's a good reason to be paranoid, which is sometimes the shock you see will be the apocalypse. You can never rule that out, right? I mean, in hindsight, it always is obvious you should have bought. So in hindsight, you should have bought in 1931, you should have bought in 1987, you should have bought in 2001, you should have bought in 2009. But that's because we've survived every one of these shocks. What if this is the shock that really drives you under, right? That's why it's not that automatic.
Capital.
I'm sorry?
Then you don't care about your capital as well.
Yeah, so that's my rationale for buying. It's not that I don't think there'll be an apocalypse, but if there's going to be an apocalypse, the last thing I care about is my portfolio. I should be collecting food and heading to the forest and perhaps getting some weapons. No. So because I don't care about my portfolio, my apocalypse, I'm more likely to buy. But I'll be selective about when I buy and where I buy. And I've said this before, make sure you pass the sleep test, which is when a crisis like this, you worry and you're afraid and you should not be doing things that make you more afraid. So if you feel that if you're already not sleeping, the last thing you should be doing is trying to buy and make yourself more scared. But there will be a point in a crisis where you start to sleep okay. That's when you should start thinking about buying. Go ahead, Sammy.
Okay. Two questions. One, are you sleeping okay? Because you said usually you would sleep for a week and then you would look at things with crisis. And the second one, I'm just, there was a question in the chat, which I would also ask, which how did you get the value of the buybacks?
Oh, for using the S&P 500, S&P actually reports it every quarter. So the buybacks are actually public information. You go to the S&P website, you can get them. Or if you use Capital IQ, buybacks are actually in the statement of cash flows. You can just add them up across companies. So it's actually public information. The only problem is it's lagging information. Expected future buybacks are what you worry about now. That we don't know. That's what we're looking at. Or companies are announcing, you know, whether they're going to keep with the buybacks. So the first wave of companies that canceled buybacks just came out last week. The airlines and the banks were the leaders in that group. And I think there'll be more coming out in the near future. Okay. And what is the other question about a week? I didn't quite get that question.
So with the start of the with the current shock in this stock market, you were talking about your personal experience, and you said usually I would prefer to sleep for a week. I would
No. I sleep for a week. If I slept for a week, I'd get really hungry. I'm saying you have to pass the sleep test, which means that when you're in a crisis, you start to worry. You worry about your health. You worry about your finances. I said, don't do anything in investing that's going to make it more difficult for you to go to sleep. So you got to get comfortable with it to the point that you're willing to take the risk. So don't do, this is not an intellectual exercise. It's got to be okay with your stomach. Otherwise, you're going to do stupid things. So that's what I meant by the sleep test. Nothing to do with the week there. Okay. But you got to get comfortable enough that you're willing to pull the trigger.
Thank you.
Okay. The one final question was estimating why G is equal to the risk-free rate. We're reaching the end. So rather than try to explain it, go back and review your terminal value notes, which is way back in time. And I give you an explanation for why the nominal growth rate for the economy in perpetuity and the risk-free rate kind of stand in for each other. So give it a shot. Check your terminal value notes. Yeah. Somebody brought up black swan. Black swans, white swans. Yeah, you can have a black swan, but it's not a question of whether, it's the question of whether the black swan is the last swan you'll ever see. Because if you just get a black swan, you know, 2 weeks later, it's back to being white swans, you can survive. So the key in this crisis is to make sure that the company you're picking will survive and come back, even assuming there will be, you know, even if you assume there's going to be a comeback, the company you pick has to be around for you to make money when you come back. So that's why I want you to think about that failure risk that I talked about and incorporating it into your valuation, because that's going to become a key driver into whether you buy a Boeing or a United Airlines. And that's why today, when the rescue package was announced, the Boeing was up 17%, because you reduced the failure risk dramatically. But a bailout, you got to be careful. If the bailout comes at the expense of your equity being written off, which is what happened in 2009 with GM, your company might come back, but your equity will not. So no other questions? Okay, folks, I think we're out of time, so I'm going to stop the share and quit Zoom. But thank you very much, and I'll see you soon. Take